You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Annie Cocobobo. She's a professor and assistant professor and director of graduate studies. And we're going to be talking to her from Kansas. And she also has interest in 19th century Russian literature. And we're going to be touching on some of those aspects. Annie, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is? I mean, you know, I haven't been to Kansas. So Lawrence, Kansas, is it small town, big town? What is Lawrence, Kansas?
It's a college town. I grew up in New York, so this is very much like, it feels like an East Coast small town, college town. And this is where the University of Kansas is. So this is where the big basketball team is. Anybody follows March Madness and all that good stuff.
So let's talk about the book you're working on, which we can talk about in a number of ways, I imagine. But what is the book that you're working on at the moment? I know you've written others, but what's happening now?
So this is my second book, and this is focused on a Jewish Soviet writer, Vasily Grossman. He died in 1964, but before that, he was a journalist and writer for many years. His major books are Life and Fate, and then later Everything Flows, and they're both repressed. And so I'm really interested in, you know, talking about by the Soviets, obviously. And I'm really interested in talking about his writing and sort of the themes there, but also, I think he's really relevant to our present in a number of ways. So my book kind of does both of those things.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because I know I also just read an article that you wrote about Ivanka Trump's new book, and there's so many things going on, you know, now politically. To talk a little bit more about this book, you're looking at Russia through the lens of this writer, right? I mean, that's part of your angle into this, and what is his, or as you're drawing from, I guess, his writings and his life, how are you seeing into Russia that way, if that sounds appropriate? What is that illuminating for you?
Of course. So he is a 20th century writer, and I my training is in the 19th century. So when I look at him, I see all of Russia in a sense, right? And he, one of my favorite works by him is his last novel. It's called Everything Flows, and it was written basically for the drawer. That's the term that, you know, would ring very true with scholars of the 20th century Russian literature, because basically he knew that he had no chance of publishing this book. The Soviets had taken his major book, Life and Fate. The KGB took it basically and told him that he couldn't publish this, and that centuries would need to go by before he could publish this. And so he knew that he couldn't publish freely, but at that point he said, okay, fine, I'm going to speak my mind, right? And his big argument about Russia is that Russia hasn't really known freedom ever. It has known many, many other things, many advancements and achievements, but it has never known freedom. And that Lenin came to power thinking he would do something different, but actually the Soviets just capitalized on this tradition of Russian non-freedom. And in fact, he argues that everything that Russia has accomplished in every other sphere is, in fact, perhaps founded on this lack of freedom, which I think is really interesting. But if you look at his work, and he connects to other writers, to like Dostoevsky, but if you look at his work, you see sort of the good and the bad of this, you know, and I think it's really interesting because it also sort of, it reveals this uniqueness of the Russian perspective, which, you know, scholars have talked about for years and years and years. I don't know if that answered your question at all.
It does. So I have a number of more questions because of that. In his first book that was repressed, was that touching on similar ideas? Was that also about
absolutely.
Russia not knowing freedom?
No, and, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
And so his second book that he wrote, how did that differ from the first one? And was that one published?
No. Well, there were in the, you know, they were published in the West in the 80s. But yeah, no, so basically, so he has a background as a journalist. He traveled with the Red Army for years and years, right? He went, he was one of the first people to write about Nazi death camps. He wrote about Treblinka. He was one of the first people to go there in 1944 with the Soviet Army. And he saw that, and he saw what the Nazis had done, and he really like wanted to uncover that. And he went and interviewed survivors. But at that time, he believed that perhaps the Soviet Union would be different, right? He thought of the Soviet Union as a power for good. And then eventually, after encountering the anti-Semitism of that regime and seeing all the purges and what Stalin was doing, he grew, of course, deeply disenchanted. So Life and Fate is basically about how Stalinism and Stalin's regime was equivalent to Nazi Germany in many ways, and sort of as a kind of larger argument for against authoritarianism, against totalitarianism. And then, which obviously, even though during Khrushchev's time, you know, things had changed, there was this national sense of national shame in the Soviet Union, and they didn't feel comfortable with his book. So they took it away. And for him, this was devastating. You know, he saw this book almost like a person. He dedicated it to his mother, who had been killed by the Nazis in Ukraine. She was a Jew. She, you know, like everyone else, she was basically killed, and he didn't find her. He went to basically to be told by her neighbors that she had been killed by the Nazis. So it was devastating for him that they took this book.
And it was devastating, as you're saying, that the book was never published. But was there a chance for that being published? I mean, it sounded like in the context he was in the time he was in, how could a book like that, he could have hoped for a book like that to be published in Russia? Or is it because, as you were saying, he thought it would be different and that they would receive it this time?
So, mind you, this was the thaw, right? This was the 50s, and after Stalin had died, this was Khrushchev's time. So he thought, okay, maybe if I'm sort of, because he's not as direct about what was wrong with the Soviet Union at large as he is in the second book, right, that I mentioned, Everything Flows. So I think he thought, perhaps, you know, there may be a possibility that people will read this and be willing to, you know, look back and reflect on Stalinism without, you know, getting defensive, right?
Right.
So there was a slight chance, but I think that you know, the party officials read it and they understood the deeper implications of it and what it would say about Russia and its history and everything. And he was told by the KGB that 100, 200 years would have to go by for this to ever be published. And I think at that point he really was devastated because this was his life's work. He had written other books, but this was the first time where he felt, okay, I'm really writing like a free man. I'm really thinking like a free man. And freedom is really important to how he views the world. So then in the second book, there was basically no holds barred. He writes about the Gulag. He writes about the Ukrainian Holodomor, basically where Stalin's regime essentially starved millions of Ukrainians to death, which is still controversial. It's still something that even right now the Russian government will not acknowledge. So he writes about this, and for him to have written about this in the 50s is to me outstanding.
And so to talk about freedom as he's talking about it, and also in the broad sense of Russia has never known freedom, how do you define freedom in that sense? And would you say, I mean, obviously we're saying in this case that the United States has known freedom or is free?
I don't know. That's a good question. So for him, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question, and I think that's part of how he views this, right? Because, you know, always the grass is greener on the other side. But yeah, he views the West as this, as, you know, he sees the history of the West as going from less to more freedom, whereas Russia is going in reverse in his mind, as though it's kind of returning to non-freedom. So that's the major difference for him. And I think it's really interesting. And then you think, you know, what does it mean to go from less to more freedom, right? So, of course, I think we think of ourselves as free now. But is that, you know, and to my mind, is that sort of, you know, what liberals have been saying? Is it about inclusion? Is that what it's about? It's about allowing everyone to have the same amount of freedom? And how does that factor different things? I mean, it's very complicated.
And so as you're reading this book, I mean, without comparing it to the West, it does seem very sweeping to say Russia has never known freedom, you know, and as an artist, I think, well, under great repression in Russia, all kinds of art has come out of there, of course, like the great writers that you know of the 19th century, as well as plenty of visual artists
of the 20th
century. So what does freedom mean in that sense? It sounds like it sounds so claustrophobic and like it would make it impossible for any artists, writers to express themselves. So what does that really mean for Russia to have never known freedom?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question because I think it gets me to another part of this that I think is really important. That I think he means in the sense that this is actually this is a Gulag survivor, right? This is a person who is politically repressed who writes this. All of this. So it's really also interesting that it's coming from his perspective too. But you know, I think what's interesting is that he says yes, Russia has not known freedom in terms of like a government, right, that facilitates it. But then the thing that he says is that ultimately freedom is life. And one of the arguments he makes is that in order to kill freedom, Stalin basically had to kill life. He had to kill so many people, right? Because for him, you know, our humanity is founded on freedom. And so it's very hard to take that away because, you know, you have this man, Ivan, who's a sort of quintessential Russian name, right? It's like John, basically. So you have Ivan who has survived the Gulag. This is in the last novel, Everything Flows. And he comes back. And it's still, you know, the Soviet period, obviously, and there's still fears and everything. But, you know, you see him at the end of the book, and even though he's been imprisoned and everything, he's really free. You know, he goes back to his hometown, and and there's this passage where Grossman says he's basically the same. Sort of all of the suffering, all of the repression kind of washes off of him, and he thinks about his mother, you know, he thinks about his childhood.
And yeah, that's so interesting because it makes me think of other people like Viktor Frankl or Elie Wiesel who are Holocaust survivors. And in the context of what you're saying, I think a type of freedom for both of them was surviving in order to write the books that they wrote. But still, what does it mean then to not have freedom? If Russia has never known freedom, is that about public self-expression? What does that exactly mean?
Yeah, and I think that that's really interesting. And I think the way that he views it is that, you know, each person has to sort of navigate their own sense of freedom, right? And you see people respond to this differently, right? So there are people that are willing to give in their own sense of morality, right? They're willing to essentially succumb their own sense of the world to how the system views the world, right? And they just accept what is being given to them. And I think Grossman was one of those people at one point, right, where he kind of accepted the official party line. But then at some point, and critics say this about him, at some point, quote unquote, the slave in him basically was gone. At some point, he said, okay, I'm going to think and function in this system as though it were a normal system and be free. And I may not be able to publish like he wasn't, obviously, but I will think, I will speak the truth, right? So I think that that's part of it for him. But also it means that I think he has a lot more compassion toward others and the way that he views them. Like in this last book that I was talking about, Everything Flows, actually makes me think a lot about Primo Levi and his writings about the Holocaust. He talks about the moral gray zone. And for Grossman, this idea is really relevant in the context of the Soviet Union because obviously, on some level, people are complicit. They feel like they're participating or at least allowing the system to do what it wants with others. So it makes it very hard to say, okay, well, you know, I'm going to judge others for what they're doing because everyone's sort of participating on some level.
Right.
And the sense of guilt and shared shame is very problematic, and it's there in his work.
Huh. It sounds to me what he's touching on, or what you just mentioned a little bit earlier, is a kind of there's almost a way of perhaps, and just forgive me if I'm overreaching and or correct mm-hmm. me, but there's a kind of intellectual or artistic freedom. There's living in life, which is mm-hmm. maybe a type of resistance and a
mm-hmm.
you know a victory, but also there's the ability to think outside. As you're saying, the party lines, the ability to be able to make, you know, words together, images, is also a type of freedom, right? I mean, monks talk about that too, right? Being able to meditate while in jail and not letting the torture get to them or something. Or I read some things about that. Is that too far afield, or is that also what he's talking about, or what you're talking about in this book a little bit as a form of freedom? Because he is writing these books, right? So he's free to write them. He's not
Absolutely.
He's not dead, and he's
Absolutely.
Not he hasn't prevented from writing these. And artists aren't prevented from making the paintings they're making, though they may not get exhibited.
You just can't publish. Yeah, you just can't. Yeah, no one will see them. Yeah, no. And I think that's really important. But, you know, and I think it's really important for him. You know, I've read Russian literature for years and years, and I've never really heard a Russian writer be as critical of Russia as he is. I think maybe because he's also a Jew and a little bit of a foreigner, in a sense, you know. Mm. I don't think he felt like a foreigner. I think it was only when he encountered the anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union that he felt that way more. And, yeah, he's looking at it and, you know, there's this tension between the sort of Russian sense of community that's really important, how they view themselves, and then also kind of, but then you have to separate yourself too, right? And have your own sense of morality and have your own, perhaps, creativity, like you're suggesting, that allows you to, you know, determine how, you know, to speak the truth too. And I think about Grossman a lot right now as I think about, you know, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny during Putin, right now, you know, and I don't know if you've heard of him during Putin's, you know, regime, but, you know, I think of him, like, he goes and makes these, like, amazing YouTube videos about, like, corruption in Russia, but, like, basically acting as though he lives in a normal country with the rule of law, and
he's doing that, I don't know him, he's doing that from Russia, he's posting those videos.
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. Yes, and they keep finding, you know, they keep putting him in prison and doing things, and you know about Nemtsov who was murdered, right? The other opposition. This is not a place where it's easy to kind of speak truth to power, but I'm always amazed at the sort of moral courage to say, okay, you know, this is really what's happening, right? And he this was actually recently on the Rachel Maddow show, actually, some of the stuff that he had uncovered and his team had uncovered, just the corruption and the money and all of that in it was Medvedev, but, you know, people associated with Putin, basically. And it's just like, are you really writing? Are you really, like, publishing this stuff this openly? And, you know, I mean, so he's also sharing it, you know, so I think that takes it to a whole other level, perhaps, than Grossman. But, of course, it's also a different time and a different government.
But even in this current government, you know, it's, I mean, the first time that, well, not the first time, but in recent history, we've certainly heard about a lot of repression in terms of the arts. Pussy Riot got, you know, the tremendous amount of attention, and it was very disturbing what was happening there, as well as images of Putin and drag being, I don't know what they're labeled, work that you can't make, that's kind of treasonous mm-hmm. or something.
Yeah.
So it would seem that there is, in line perhaps with what he was thinking, and you're writing about, that there is this, and again, stop me if I'm overreaching, but there is this consistency with Russia and the arts and trying to stop writers or stop artists from doing certain things. Whereas, you know, here, of course, we had sculptures of a naked Donald Trump placed in numerous spots. And although that must have been upsetting to him, right in Central Park and in Union Square, and although that must have been upsetting to him, we don't have, I mean, I'm sure there must be some examples, but we don't have a tradition of cracking down on that and having those artists stop that or prohibit that. I mean, perhaps Trump might like to do something like that. But what I'm saying is that it sounds to me like this idea of freedom, specifically in the arts, being inhibited, is ongoing in Russia.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, but also like mass media too, you know, and in a more literal way, right? You know, the government essentially like monopolizing the means of the distribution of information, right? The television, you know, so most TV stations don't, you know, they can't express freely any opposition to Putin, obviously, because he, you know, owns most of them. So that, you know, the government is sort of has this monopoly over the mass media, which I think is, you know, part of why, you know, this is obviously not, it's a managed democracy at best, if anything, right? But I think that, I guess the one thing that I think is really important too is that, you know, I think because of how much Russia has been in the news and all of this stuff about Russian interference and whatnot, we also can tend to view the whole country as this kind of monolithic whole under Putin's leadership. And I think, if anything, the example of Grossman and the ability of individuals to think freely and function freely despite what their government tells them, you know, could perhaps be very instructive to us in the sense that, you know, not all Russians are you know, Putin's pawns. You know, there's this whole massive country with many, 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 many people, very different people, and, you know, they all are able to judge for themselves, and, you know, they don't agree with their government necessarily, right? They're not a reflection of their government so much as their own, you know, every person is ultimately responsible for themselves and their own sense of the world.
Right, you know, it's very interesting, and at the same time, I always think about how, and I've seen other artists reference this, about how sometimes great artists, great writers can come out of incredibly repressive, not just
Absolutely.
Regimes, but households, right? Great jazz musicians, great who were brought up in a very repressive, let's say, religious household, end up doing amazing things that is sort of I don't know, almost about resisting or something. So I mean, when, and especially all the writers that you've been reading and specializing in 19th century literature from Russia. These are all extraordinary literary figures that arose at a time. And I'm not saying because of or, but it is kind of in contrast to that. As you're saying, I guess there's a moral decision, but even a repressive government doesn't necessarily, at its most extreme, can't really stop the artist's voice or the writer's voice, right? As they haven't with the writer that you're discussing.
Well, I mean, they can stop the writer, right?
Right. They can kill the writer.
Yes, and that's the case. I mean, I think in the Soviet Union more than anything, there were so many writers that were made to disappear, and we only have uncovered Grossman being one of them, right? Because they basically he couldn't publish, so they can do that. But yeah, no, I agree with you that I think that this, you know, and people have written about this, but the sense of, you know, political repression can create a unique creative voice and. I think that is the case in Russia. And I think also the kind of attitudes that we see, the sort of, you know, like I think of Dostoevsky and as a sort of, you know, canonical Russian writer, but this idea of kind of moral, I don't know, the sense of compassion that we see in his writing. I don't know. Could that really emerge in another system? I don't know that it would necessarily. The sense of, you know, we're all these, like, you know, the suffering together, basically. So let's, you know, we have to forgive each other for our imperfections and sort of embrace each other to a point where it almost, you know, to a very extreme point for Dostoevsky, in fact, where, you know, everyone is worthy of love and compassion. So, it, you know, I think it really does create a unique and uniquely creative perspective.
I think so too. When I say that's so interesting to think about. When I think of Russian artists, I think of the Kabakovs, who were a great collaborative team, and also, of course, Kazimir Malevich, and both these artists, though they're very different. Escapism isn't quite the right word, but it's something like that. I mean, certainly in Malevich's later work, this kind of purity of the square, it's been talked about as being, a lot of things, but to me, it's something that's also, for lack of a better word, very, very spiritual or very highly intellectual, this ability to escape into kind of non-objectiveness, into something that's not figurative, and find something there is somehow somewhat radical. And more directly, the notion of the Kabakovs, and I forgot what the title of this installation was, but it was something like Man Who Goes Into Space, and it was an image of a room that's completely trashed. And you probably know this, and there's giant springs hanging from the ceiling and a bed, and it looks like the guy created this whole contraption so that he could cut the cords of this contraption with an enormous amount of tension in it, and basically blasted himself through the ceiling of his apartment and into the atmosphere, and so it looks like sort of the ultimate, like, oh my God, we're free, but both of them are, or not we're free, but like, almost ways of thinking about how to be free, in a sense. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know, that made me think sort of just organically about all the stuff about artistic resistance, like in our time, right? I don't know, when we feel kind of externally pressured or that we can't take our sense of freedom for granted, there's just like outpour of creativity and energy. I mean, think about the resistance movement in our Trump times, for instance. I don't know. I mean, I think, that many people felt that there was a sense of complacency that might have set in because they felt that they were represented, by their political systems. And then all of a sudden there's a shock to the system and there's this sort of outpour of energy and involvement, people that had never been politically involved are suddenly paying attention and doing things, myself included, I would say. Not that I was never involved, but I can sense a kind of increased level of activity in my life that I didn't before.
Oh, that's true. That's true. It's something of historic and kind of biblical proportions, right? There's never been protests like this in the history of this country. I mean, the Vietnam protests look minor compared to, the Women's March on Washington, and that was, I think, before he did anything.
No, I know.
Right?
I know.
I mean, it's kind of, that's so interesting. So one other thing I want to ask you is, you found this writer, and you're writing about this writer. And as you were saying, they can stop writers from not being published and kind of their voice not getting out there. And his voice ultimately was published, and by you writing about him, it's that much more attention. But, and I know this is kind of maybe odd territory, but aren't there like scores or hundreds of other writers that have done things that we won't know about or haven't known about or can still be found? Like, am I overstating the fact, or could there be hundreds or thousands of writers that have made books that are so important that we're not going to know because they weren't allowed to publish them?
You mean in Russia or in general?
Yeah,
or...
in Russia.
It's hard to know because we don't know them, right? I mean, I think actually to respond to that point, one, I have also been doing lately, I've worked a lot on the 19th century, but I've also been doing now starting to pay attention to women writers in Russia because, for instance, of the 19th century, we hardly ever read them. We hardly ever know anything about them. And that's a kind of different thing. It's not political repression per se. But I would say, but they're not, they're not paid attention to. And I think, to respond to your question, maybe not exact, I don't know if literally the way that you meant it, but I think the attention that we pay to writers, Grossman, I think, people do pay some attention to him. He's not completely, he's been translated, right? So, you know, I think in terms of like how much attention they're able to get, how much attention a writer gets, whether they're taught regularly, right, whether their books are sold, you know, all of this affects how much we know them, especially when they come from a different culture. And, you know, women writers are not accessible, right? I think access is really important in these questions. And so, yes, I do think that, you know, some are privileged over others, and those who aren't privileged don't get the same amount of exposure, and we don't know who they are. Like, I'm now, you know, even though my PhD is in Russian literature, right, I'm now reading some of these women writers that I hadn't read. And you know, they're wonderful.
It's very interesting. So you're saying also some of the women writers that you're finding and reading about had even less chance of visibility because, mm-hmm. unlike Grossman, they also didn't have the possibility of teaching or a number of other things, or not as much possibility.
Well, in the 19th century, especially.
Right, in the 19th century. Well, perhaps even in the 20th century, there was still a, I mean, that's certainly the case in the United States, right? It's still an uneven playing ground for men and women. And I would think that, I mean, as you're saying, that makes women and also minority writers even harder to discover at some point.
Oh, yeah. Well, and in terms of, you know, any kind of sort of gay writing in Russia, any gay writers, I mean, all of that, you know, they too have been repressed. So, you know, so yeah, there's a lot of, you know, I think, yeah. And access is, I think, what it ultimately comes down to, right? You know, if we can read this stuff.
But access in terms of, having access to being able to read it, but also having access to the figures themselves historically, mm-hmm. by being recorded sometime in history for doing something somewhat public, whether it's teaching or some kind.
Yeah, and I mean, I think in Russia too, like I think about this a lot just because I study the 19th century primarily, but I, you know, there's not, to be a writer, right, you often had to be independently wealthy. So, you know, even before the Soviet Union, right, it becomes a very self-selecting crew of people that, and a lot of them, you know, Dostoevsky was very frustrated because he was one of the few people that wasn't independently wealthy. And so he would often complain that everyone else has these, you know, piles and piles of money that, you know, they can depend on and write at their leisure, but I can't, you know. So it's very complicated questions in terms of, like, you know, distribution and access and all that.
Even before the
repression.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So when will this book come out? What is the title of this book again, and when do you imagine it'll be published?
It's very much in the early stages right now because I just finished my first book.
Okay.
But so I you know, I hope to finish in 2 years or so, but, you know, who knows? they take a long time. And I don't have a provisional title right now. Is I can tell you, it is Imagining Freedom in Authoritarian Times: Vasily Grossman, Writer, Journalist, and Whistleblower. But that may very well change.
And before we go, I want to ask you the question that I ask everyone, which is, what are you reading at the moment? Could be anything or off topic.
Well, I read lots of kids' books too, but right now it's for work. But I'm reading Timothy Snyder's On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, which I think a lot of people should read. It feels almost like a how to identify and how to behave oneself morally in a less than free society.
I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work, and I wish you the best in completing your manuscript.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.